Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Discover luxurious duvet sets today. Visit harrycurry.com for stylish comfort this spring.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Or text us on 51551. Now on to go to John. John, good afternoon.
Hello, Kitty. How are you?
Oh, another lovely Donegal accent.
Well, partly, yeah. Originally from Derry, but living here now about 50 years.
All right. It has rubbed off of it. So are you based in Letterkenny yourself?
I am indeed, Kitty, yes, yeah.
And you were listening to Martin there?
I was. I mean, I know that there are still maybe one or two people that might stop at a tourist office, but with everybody on mobile phones these days, if you're coming to Donegal, have a look at it the night before and decide where you're going. I don't think you need to stop and pick up paper brochures to decide where to go in Donegal. Letterkenny is a gateway town. You just go through the gate, turn left, right, or go straight ahead, and wherever you go, it's just going to be stunning.
Well, there's no arguing with that, I would say, but surely you need to know if there's something on, or, you know, if there's a festival or you know, any particular thing of interest. Would that not
be? But there are so many. I mean, take example, TripAdvisor. Any one of the mobile phone apps will tell you what's on without having to stop, physically get out of your car, go into a tourist office and pick up a paper brochure to tell you what you could look up on your phone in 2 minutes. I mean, in this day and age, it's not rocket science. Now, I understand there are some people that still like to go into a tourist office, but personally, I've never been in one in my life nor never felt the need for one.
Do we still have Martin there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
What do you think about that, Martin? Actually, it is a good point. People do generally go searching for stuff on their phones now if they're looking into something.
Yeah, that's all right. But a lot of people come to Ireland, they may not have roaming service. So they may look up before they come here that they have that they're a tourist office. And that's automatically the place they'll gravitate to get the information as to where they'll go in that area.
Yeah, well, I suppose the proof of the pudding is, John, is the fact that when Martin was there last week or the week before, that there was three other cars full of tourists, actually, who had pulled up at the tourist office hoping to get some info.
Yeah, it's fair. But if they had got into their car and went out of the town and had taken any one of the compass points, they would have ended up somewhere nice. And that lady was on the phone earlier about Star Wars and Skellig Meikle. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, we have a Star Wars site at Malin Head, only 4 hours from Dublin, and it's free. So, I mean, you know, there's a lot of things there. If you go online, you'll find them. Donegal is just awash with beautiful walks, beautiful cycle trails, beautiful beaches, mountains. There's no need for, well, there may be a small need for a tourist office, but I don't think it's a major necessity.
But I suppose, is the point that Martin was making that that you should be taking, in a fall to Ireland, should be taking every opportunity to push?
Ireland have ads on the television all the time showing the beauty of Donegal and the Wild Atlantic Way. I mean, that a lot of the places are, I mean, and they're well known now just through TV and radio ads. I know I'm not slagging off Martin, but I mean, to be sitting in a tourist office today in Letterkenny with the sun shining outside wouldn't be a job I would want personally at the moment.
Well, there's many of us would rather be out in the sunshine than where we're at work today, John. But
you mightn't want that job, but if you were a tourist provider, you might like people to call to your place because they got the information from the tourist office. Again, I don't really agree with you that there's no need for a tourist office, because tourist offices tend to have information about local areas, local places. You talked about walks, as many as you find walks. People are not going to come into Letterkenny and say, well, I'll turn right and I'll go walking somewhere up there. They like to find out about particular places to walk.
Not all highly advertised online?
Yeah, but as I mentioned, not everybody that comes to Ireland might have a roaming service. You know, the roaming service can be quite expensive if they're using it here in Ireland. They might have some homework done, but they might say, well, listen, there's a tourist office. I'll get my information there.
Well, that's fair. I know now that a lot of...
You know, I'm not saying that doesn't happen.
I'm a golfer in Donegal. I mean, and we have huge golf tourism here at the moment, but it's all pre-done. It's booked from January every year for the rest of the year. They don't even need, you know, But I would imagine that anybody who's come into Ireland should have looked up a certain amount of where they want to go or what they want to see.
Well, there's that lady from that was on from Kerry, Christine, who unfortunately couldn't go to Skellig-Michael, and her, especially her 14-year-old son. It'll be very disappointing for him. But as John says, there's a Star Wars site in Malinhead. If you wanted to see puffins, go out to Tory Island. You just pay for the ferry. It's free to walk around the island. You'll see the puffins. Tory Island, Arranmore Island has some of the best sea caves if people are into kayaking and stuff like that. Yeah, all that information is available in the tourist office.
Well, it's all available on Liveline now. Martin, I think you're worth about 5 tourist offices.
No, I still won't reach Daniel O'Donnell's height.
Right. Martin, thanks very much. I want to bring in, and John, thanks. I want to bring in Paul now, another part of Ireland and also in the tourist trade, Paul.
Hello, how are you?
You're in Wexford Town, Paul.
I'm in Wexford Town, sunny. It's like Mexico and Wexico this week. It's absolutely gorgeous.
Brilliant. And but you're also, as I say, in the tourist game. Tell us exactly what your business is.
I am. So I run a business called Wex Walks. So we're a walking tour in Wexford Town. Some people will probably know Wexford is actually a Viking town. And we have a lot of the Viking city, the Norman city, and all the buildings from the 16th, 17th century left, as well as the beautiful quayfront and the history of the 1798 rebellion and everything else. So there's so many places to bring people in Wexford Town. It's fantastic.
I'm looking at a picture of you right now, Paul.
And well, I'm very subtly dressed, I'd say. Is that me in my full Norman garb? It is.
That is you in your full regalia. You would not be missed. Anyone who's passed through Wexford Town will not have missed you. Let me just say that.
No, I mean, you have to dress up. You have to look nice. That's always my answer, you know.
Right. Now, I know there is an issue because it's not only yourself that's been talking to us about this, but there's an issue about signage that...
Sure.
So tell us about that. What's the problem?
Okay, so like many service providers in tourism, also, of course, in the catering trade, everything else, people have used signs on streets to advertise their business. Now, from my own point of view, I'm the walking tour. I start in the centre of town in Wexford. It's a place called the Bullring. And apparently there's a new EU mandate which gets rid of all signs. Now, obviously, it's an outdoor tour. I don't have a shop front. That sign has been my shop front since I opened it. We're actually 3 years old 2 days ago, believe it or not. So happy birthday to us. But now all those signs have to go, I'm afraid. And that sign, I did a research last year, asked everybody how to find the tour, and it's worth about 36% of my business. So I'm a little bit worried that the signs going might affect the business to a degree where I can't really operate the way I've operated for the last 3 years. So that's the kind of basic version of what's happened at the moment.
And my understanding is that this has been kind of rumbling for a while, hasn't it? These warnings that these signs are not authorised.
Yeah, it came up in February. All the local councillors were informed. As I said, it's above local council head. Apparently, it's an EU mandate, but everybody in town, the council and the councillors and everybody else, tried their best to suit it. And in February, it kind of seemed to disappear. But then, not last week, the week before, a letter went out at the start of the week to say that, unfortunately, they all had to go before the weekend.
Before the weekend? This is it?
So it was only... it was last weekend. It was actually last... Friday, not Friday, just gone the Friday before. And I have noticed last week I had a sharp decline in my sales last week. Because it was really interesting. I was listening to the two guys talking about tourist offices there before you brought me on. Mm-hmm. And we lost ours 2 years ago. And a lot of the older people, I find, because walking tours are perfect, older couples in a town like Wexford, they come on the tours, but they don't necessarily use Facebook or TikTok or any of those things. So really, they do find my tour because of the sign. So at the moment, I'm in talks with the council, with some businesses, to see what we can do, because I did really notice a sharp drop-off last week. A huge one, put it this way. So I had that for 2 months, the business will be gone.
And your sign, I mean, it's not a huge sign. It's one of those kind of standalone.
It's kind of a 2 foot by 1 foot sign in the middle of a square. Now, I know what the big problem is in a lot of towns, and Wexford's a Viking town, our streets are very small. Some of them are being thrown across lanes and streets, and it is an issue for wheelchair access and for people with sight differences and things like that. And I know probably 1,000 of your comments are going to say that. I totally understand that. That's why I think I'm hoping someone at government level can come in, talk to the councils, and let it be all right for councils to talk to people on an individual basis, to show somebody from the council where these signs are, what the safety precautions are, and how it won't affect people with those issues, so that we can all get on, so people can walk safe, and also we can run our businesses. I do think there's middle ground here, but I think someone from the government really needs to talk to local councils about it, because at the moment my feeling is that it's all sort of being blanket covered, and it's going to affect businesses negatively. And as I said, I'm not talking about being able to throw them wherever you want. I'm talking about putting them somewhere very safe, very visible for everybody, so Welcome. That we can all be safe and make money at the same time.
Yeah, because this is what the Wexford County Council will say. They're saying that this is an action they're taking in the interest of public safety and accessibility. Will you hang on a minute, Paul, because we have Liam on the other line. Liam O'Grady, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for having me on the show.
Now, you have a shop front, but you don't have footfall past it. Is that your problem, Liam?
Yeah, I'm up off the main street as well now, where, your footfall would be quite limited as well. So you kind of hope to... that a lot of people driving by and stuff like that, you know, when they're getting around the town would see your shop and come into it. Unfortunately, a couple of years ago, they closed off the street, so we don't have that now either.
So what's your business?
I have a body piercing studio in Wexford Town called Be Pierced.
Be Pierced. And do you get a lot of kind of drop-ins for that kind of thing?
Yeah, because we operate with walk-ins and bookings. So we always leave enough slots open for say, somebody like yourself or Paul, whoever, who wanted to just walk in during the day to get a piercing done. So, and that would be the large part of my business now.
Right. So what kind of signage have you had that's now in dispute?
I had 2 bollard sleeves, which are the ones that fit over the council bollards that they put at the edge of the road. And then I have a sign similar to Paul's, where it's just a standalone sandwich board that I put at the end of the street. So anybody driving up past the road, because they now can't get up it, will see a sign to say, Be Pierced, and an arrow pointing that direction.
OK, I'm looking at the statement from the letter that the council sent out to you, and they are telling you, please be advised that this practice is contrary to the Litter Pollution Act 1997, and you were requested to remove all advertising material from the bollards. This is the bollard sleeves that you have out there within 7 days, and they were threatening you with on-the-spot fines of €150 or prosecution. This has been, again, going on for some time, Liam, discussions about these signs.
Yeah, look, I'm 9 years in business now, and I'd say about a year in, I received one of those letters, and I got quite a fright at the time. I pulled in my signs, and there was a massive drop at the time. I actually said I'd rather pay the fine than lose customers, sort of put them back out. And this was even before they closed the road, because I think people had got used to seeing my signs there, and when they weren't there, they thought we were closed. Maybe walked up the street, turned around and left again. So I said I'd pay the fine, I'd leave my signs out. There was never a problem with anybody walking by saying they had an issue or anything like that. If there was, you know, I have kids, I push chairs and stuff, I wouldn't have them out if they were in the way. So I said, I'll leave the signs out, I'll pay the fine. Thankfully, the fine never came. But in the last year and a half now, I've gotten three more letters.
I'm just looking at the statement we have from Wexford County Council. They're saying that Wexford Town is characterised by its narrow medieval street layout, which, while contributing greatly to its historic charm, also presents challenges in terms of space and accessibility. And then they say, in addition, the proliferation of unregulated signage does detract from the visual appeal of our towns, which we work hard to maintain for residents, visitors and businesses alike. You see, a lot of people really don't like this kind of street furniture, whatever. They don't think it looks well, basically.
Yeah, look, I've never had very many people say that to me where I think it'd be an issue in terms of someone saying, I've seen the sign, I don't like it, so I won't go into the shop. So I'd be kind of thinking, if I can get people to see the sign, they know I'm there. It's a potential customer or a potential recommendation to a customer at some point. But when, from a visual point of view, I think that's perspective, really, you know.
Sorry, Liam, what's on your sign? Is there like piercing? Is there photographs or anything like that?
Just the name of the shop and Body Piercing and Body Jewellery Specialist.
Right.
So there's no photos of piercings or anything like that done. And if there were, they'd be very tasteful too, you know.
Right. Do you only do the tasteful ones, Liam?
We do all of them, and they're all tasteful, yeah. Right. So there wouldn't be a shock factor in anything, if you get me, you know.
Yeah, so it's not that,
it's just,
basically.
Just simple signage to say the shop is there, especially because they closed the road. And Paul will attest to it as well. In the last few years, there have been a lot of roads closed in Wexford Town, and a lot of roads have been made one-directional stuff. So it seems like they've made a little ring road in town, so they're actually directing traffic out of the town and away from it. And because they've done that, the traffic down on the town now is very much so minimised. So, like what myself and Paul and the other business owners would like to do, is get the attention of the people that are there. Anyone that is driving by, you want to get their attention, because there's a lot less people walking on the town now because they've made the roads harder to get down. Like, for example, my parents or any of my older cousins or anything like that, if they were to drive into town now, they'd find it very, very hard to get down the town.
And does the pedestrianisation of the street not encourage people in, no?
Unfortunately, no, because it's making it more difficult. And I argued that from the very, very get-go. Places like Waterford City and a few other small towns where they've pedestrianised it got a lot quieter once they did that. Because for some people, they don't want to have to walk down the town. Then you have people that might have a disability or an injury or something that's holding them back from that long walk, which was the situation for me in the past, so I can understand that. So when I look at a street that's closed off, I see a road that shops on that street that not everybody can access.
Okay. Have you pulled in your signs now? Where are your signs today?
All this week now they're in the shop, and I really want to get them back out.
Right. And how's business today?
And I'm 9 years in business. I'm well established. People come from all over to get piercings done. Thankfully, because I'm well established, but I'm looking at so many shops closing down in town right now that if I opened in the last 2-3 years, I can't say for sure if I would be still there.
How many staff do you have, Liam?
There's 9 of us now in total, 3 full-time or 3 part-time.
Right. And how's business today?
It was pretty good today with the fine weather now.
Yeah. Do people go for piercings in the fine weather?
They do. They love getting out into the town.
What is the most popular piercing, actually, Liam?
Any in the ear, really. It's come a long way now. In the last few years, it's a massive uptake on piercings. You'll have anybody from 8 to 86 in my shop any given day. And when you start talking about things like 86 and all, you might start looking at some people that would have mobility problems. So we do like the idea of something coming in to say signage has to be a certain size and in a certain area, because you don't want to impede these people getting around. You don't want to impede them doing their daily tasks, going to the shops, or if they want to get something for themselves, like a piercing or body jewellery, and they're not the people that would shop online with me, they want to come into a shop. You want them to get by these signs. So we like the idea of a mandate coming in, but because we need these signs to advertise our shops, we have to have some sort of signage.
Okay, so there has to be some compromise. What is the oldest person you've given a piercing to, Liam?
Sure, we'd be piercing people of all ages, so I think it might be a little bit rude if I start naming out name numbers there that now might be old, but I would have people well in their 80s now coming in for piercings.
Right, okay.
And jewellery as well, they love their bit of bling, and they should have it, and they should be able to get to these shops.
Okay, Liam. Liam, thanks very much, and best of luck with that. We'll keep an eye on what's going on there in Wexford.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Visit one of our 44 stores across Ireland for quality curtains and bedding at great prices. Find your perfect style today.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, yesterday we were talking to some fantastic women about how they came to terms with losing their hair when they were going through cancer treatment, and you know how much your identity is tied in with your hair for all of us. Well, for a lot of us anyway. Susan, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie. How are you?
God, Susan, you have been through the wars, not once but twice.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah, I had cancer in 2008. I was 43, so I was quite young to have breast cancer, and then I got a recurrence again 15 years later. So I had treatment again last year, and it was just listening to the ladies on yesterday, and I was just, you know, listening to the difference, I suppose, in those 15 years from the treatment I had and dealing with, you know, the hair loss and what was available then and what's available to us now is just is vast now, the difference.
Do you mind me asking, Susan, what age would you have been when you were diagnosed the first time?
First time I was 43 and found the lump myself. It was sailed through the treatment, I must say. I had a lumpectomy. I had 4 rounds of chemo. I suppose the biggest part for me was I had to go to St. Luke's in Dublin for radiotherapy, and I live in West Donegal. So we're very fortunate here. We have an airport that flies to Dublin every day, and there are cancer flights, which would reduce price. And I went up every Monday morning, and along with a lot of other people, we were going to St. Luke's as well, and we came down on Friday evenings together.
That's a fantastic service, isn't it? I've spoken to some of the people behind that, and it is a fantastic
wonderful service.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was.
So you, as you say, you sailed through the treatment, which is a very positive way to recall it. But you did lose your hair at that time.
I did, yeah, and I mean, I was absolutely dreading that part because obviously, as some of the girls were saying yesterday, your hair really does define you. And, you know, I had, you know, good, healthy, long kind of shoulder length hair, and I had 3 children, and I was trying to think how they were going to deal with it as well. They were all teenagers, but I thought the best thing to do was bit by bit. I got it cut shorter and shorter leading up towards chemo until I got it was very short, and I really didn't like it. And I, you know, it was just it was from a confidence point of view, it was difficult. But I got it. I decided then, as soon as it was actually my daughter noticed some of the hair was starting to fall on, you know, the back of the couch where I was leaning against. And my husband said, listen, it's time to get the hair off. So I went up to the local hairdresser. She shaved the hair off for me. She was fabulous. And there was nobody else in the hairdressers at the time. And I kind of, it was funny because I did kind of, it wasn't a bad look for me. So, I think you have that initially, you have that Sinead O'Connor look where you've got the shadow of your hair still there before you have your chemo. So it's you still have that kind of dark look. You've got your eyebrows, you've got your eyelashes, so you know where your makeup goes and where it stops. But after a few weeks, all of that went, and that was very difficult. Like, to actually do your own makeup, draw your eyebrows, like I used to put them on and take them off and put them on with the pencil, trying to get it right. And I think that was a huge learning experience for me this time. I approached it very differently.
Yeah, because that was the thing. It did come up yesterday as well, the idea that your hair goes from everywhere, doesn't it? I mean, it's not just the top, the hair on your head. So you did, I mean, was it traumatic getting it shaved that time?
It was. I think it was traumatic watching other people's reaction, you know, like looking at my mum and, you know, the kids. And, you know, I was prepared. I had 2 wigs, as they were called back then, as they seem to be more hair pieces now. And I got 2 slightly different colours and lengths, but I could not wear them because of I was going through a very, the chemo just put me, fast-tracked me through an early menopause, and there's the heat and the itch, and they just weren't as comfortable then. So I find it more difficult. Other people, so I was wearing scarves all the time, and it's very obvious when you're wearing a scarf that you're going through some kind of treatment. So that bit was difficult, but after a while, everybody gets used to you, you know, looking like that. But it was, I could hear it in the girls' voices yesterday on your call, and I just thought, yeah, I know exactly how that Yeah. How did that feel?
I'm sure so many people could relate to what was what those callers were saying to us yesterday. And one of them actually had the beanies with the little hair piece at the front and at the back to kind of give the impression of hair, which I thought sounded like a great idea if the wig was uncomfortable.
What I did this time, though, as I say, with that in mind and knowing all of that and having experienced that, I actually went to a girl, she's up in Tyrone in the north of Ireland, Shauna Heaney, and she does microblading, and I got my eyebrows microbladed, so like they're tattooed on, before I went for chemo. And that made a huge difference for me because I could work my eye makeup, and I kind of knew where, you know, everything started and finished, and it definitely improved the look without the hair.
This time when you got diagnosed the second time, I mean, obviously devastating on any level.
Yeah.
Did the hair thing matter as much this time?
Yeah, probably no. I'd say not as much, even though it was kind of like it takes a long time for it to grow back in. And even though it was 15 years, you know, it didn't feel like 15 years. But I just know this time that I've got to go through all that. It's the regrowth bit is kind of, it's messy, you know, it's coming in bits and fits and starts and stops, and it's baby hair and all that. But no, I actually went with, I've got two sisters and they came with me and one of their friends, and we all went together to the same hairdresser, and she took the hair off for me there, and they were more upset than me. They were all sitting around crying. I was kind of like, listen, you've got to be practical. You've got to be practical about this. And I knew I had still had all the scarves that I'd had before, and I got a few new ones. And I got, I actually wasn't going to get a wig this time, but my daughter was getting married in July, and that was slap in the middle of the chemotherapy. So I thought I wanted to look as normal as I possibly could. I looked myself that day. So I went to a girl over in Ardara here in Donegal, creative hairdresser, her name's Sharon, and she's going through her own cancer journey, and she was just an absolute angel. And she helped me pick a wig. She styled it, and I literally only wore it three times. I wore it for my daughter's wedding, her after party, and then my niece got married four weeks later. But she did a great job. I didn't even have to go to, I mean, once I had picked the wig, I could just send the hairpiece over to her and she would style it, and I'd get it back.
In a taxi.
And just pop it on the day of the wedding, because, you know, you're not in the form really for travelling either. But she was fabulous. And but again, I still preferred the scarves.
It must have been tough being mother of the bride, being self-conscious about your hair, and obviously not feeling well at the time.
Yeah, I was very lucky. I had a meeting with the oncologist, and I asked her if I could have a break the week before the wedding, so that I knew that I would definitely make it, because if I'd had chemo that Monday, I would never have been well enough on the Friday. So he was very accommodating. And but the build up's hard, because it's the leap, you know. Listen, my daughter was getting married. I was so excited for her. But what, you know, normally you'd be running for your outfits and your, you know, what hair, what hat am I going to wear? And all of those things weren't important to me. And, you know, everybody was talking about the wedding and discussing what they're going to wear, and, you know, away getting fascinators and hats. And I just knew that wasn't going to be part of my journey for the wedding. But at the same time, we had a wonderful day. She got married in Glenveagh National Park at Glenveagh Castle here in Donegal, outside, beautiful, sunny June bank holiday. And nobody was looking at me as if, you know, there's somebody that's going through cancer treatment, because I looked pretty okay. And I had my nice wig on and my dress. And
your microbladed eyebrows.
And my microbladed eyebrows, which people still talk to me about to this day, because they're still there. And we had a great day, and it was all worth it in the end up.
How are you now, Susan?
I'm not bad. I have to this hormone pills, is, I suppose. Everybody thinks when you're chemo and everything's over, that's the end of your cancer journey. It goes on, unfortunately, for a lot of people. The first time I was on hormone pills for 8 years, and they didn't bother me at all. They were like, it was like taking Smarties. And then this time I'm on a different one because it's of age and different, I suppose, type maybe of cancer. But it is, very difficult, from pain, joint pain, muscle pain. And they just strip all the estrogen out of your body, and your body needs estrogen. So I'm getting there, and slowly but surely I'm hoping that my body will start to get used to those pills, and I'll start to feel much better.
Susan, so do we.
You
have such a lovely, lovely attitude. If you want to hang on, if you have time, you might like to listen to Lorraine. We have Lorraine on the other line.
Sure.
Thanks, Susan. Lorraine, how are you?
Hello, how are you? I'm okay. I'm good.
Now, Lorraine, you're
a little bit
different.
Though, so I'm croaky.
Okay, right. But you're a little bit different from our other callers on this, because you shaved your head even though you didn't have cancer.
Yes. I shaved my head because my husband had cancer, and a couple of people in my locality were going through the same treatment as well, and I just felt I had to do something. So I decided, I went down to our local centre called Lark, they do treatments and residential care for people going through treatment and their family. And they do, like, massages and Reiki, and they do, they're just amazing, amazing people. They're gorgeous. So I talked to the head there, Bernie, and I told her what I was going to do, and she sort of looked at me as if I was mad. She said, "Are you sure you want to do this?" I said, "Yes, I want to do it." So that was April 2 years ago, and I did it in our local pub, Murta's, and I raised 5,000.
5,000 euro?
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
So at least I felt I was doing something.
And how did it feel, actually, getting your hair shaved? Was it?
It was weird. It was kind of... I thought about it for a good while beforehand, I to make sure this was right. And my husband said, you're very brave. And I said, it's hair. It'll grow back. And it was my choice. I was lucky. I my heart goes out to all those ladies and people who had to go through, you know, not pleasant experiences. But this was my choice to try and help those people. So I went down, and my friend Bridget, used to be a hairdresser, and she did it in the pub. And of course, people were all standing around looking in horror, because I tick sort of dyed blonde shoulder length hair, and it was just coming off in masses and masses. And but it was a great night, and I had great support, and it was great fun. And I looked a bit weird and everything else, but sure, it grew back pretty quickly. So I was very glad I did it, and I wanted to do it for my husband.
And your husband, did he lose his hair through his treatment as well?
It thinned. He didn't lose it completely. It thinned quite a lot, and like that, he also had a massive thick head of healthy hair. So, but it didn't bother him really. You know, he said it is what it is. He was a very practical man, very practical.
I know you were a long time together. I think 36 years altogether, Lorraine.
Yes, 36 years together. We were 33 years married, and we would have been 34. He died in July, and we were married in November. So, it was tough. It was tough. It was very tough.
And had it been a long road for
Dave? Yeah. In a sense, he'd had cancer 13 years before this time, you know, and it was very, very early pancreatic, and he was very lucky, and it was detected very quickly, and it was only because he was going through other health problems to do with the gallbladder that they had found it. And anyway, he had the operation. Everything went well. It was a big operation, you know. But he came through that, and after care and treatment and everything else, and he was great. He was doing really well. And then about roughly 13 years later, then it came back in the stomach. And that was quite bad. And he had, I think it was a third or two thirds of the stomach was removed. Mm-hmm. And it was a big operation, obviously, and lots of chemo. And it was a very tough time for him. But he was very lucky in the part of the stomach that was removed. He didn't have to use, tube feeds or peg treatments or feeds or anything like that. And he was able, over gradually, to eat fairly normally. Obviously, he had to eat very small amounts first to let his stomach adapt. So he was doing very well. And then he was still having treatment after. Then he was good. And then he went back again for more treatment. And they discovered it had spread to the liver. So that was May. Yeah, that was May. And when I always remember because we went in and the team up in Vincent's on the ecology ward, they were just amazing, the people. And the nurse was saying, and he knew himself, the chemo was really bringing him down and it was so hard on him. And, it was horrible. So we went in and at that stage, we both said, we think there's more matter of time now. We really didn't think it was going well. Mm-hmm. But we thought 6 months. When the nurse said, well, Dave, what do you think? And he said 6. And I was thinking the same. And she said, well, I'm sorry. But she says, we're really looking more like 3. So that was a shock, a big shock.
Yeah.
I know 6 is still awful. But it was like, oh, my God, we've only half that time left together. So I had to actually leave the ward. I said, oh, Dave, there's a lady out here. I just have to see her for a second. She's going in. She's worried. Because I didn't want to upset him more. And I just had to go out and have a big cry, obviously. So I came back in and we sat and chatted and everything. And he was just so calm and he was just so incredible. And we went home and we talked. And we all discussed this with the family, and it was his decision, and he didn't want any more treatment. He said, I want to have some little bit of quality of life and enjoy my wife and my son and my grandchildren. And it was beautiful 3 months in lots of ways. And towards the end, we had the palliative care team in, who were just unbelievable. I can never thank them enough. They were just incredibly good people. So he was very lucky. I looked after him at home, and he died very peacefully here at home with all of us with him.
It's, I can't imagine after, sharing your life for 36 years with somebody to have to accept that and move on.
It was tough. It was very tough. I mean, we were very close and we'd loads of things in common, and he had a great sense of humour, great outlook on life and everything. And before he died, he really tried to help me. And he was worrying about me, of course. That was the way he was. And he was trying to give me, now if this happens, this is in the file, and go to that file, and there's this password, and there's this number, and get your notebook out. And, thinking ahead all the time. He was so thoughtful.
I don't want to speed up, but I do want to get to the happy ending here, because there is a happy ending for you, Lorraine.
Yes, there was a most unexpected happy ending.
Yeah.
Ending. About slightly less than a year after he died, I was out with friends. I hadn't been going out very much because I hated coming home to an empty house. And I had my animals, which I loved and he loved. So, but he wasn't there. So that was the whole thing. But anyway, I started literally only going out the odd time over a couple of weeks. And I went down to a friend's house one evening and we were just having a takeaway and a glass of wine. And they said, oh, we're just going to go up to the local for one. And I said, oh, here, I'll go for one on the way home. So it's a local little rural pub. It's lovely and everything else. So we went in and we were just sitting at the bar. And there happened to be a man sitting beside where I was sitting, and they knew him, and they introduced us. So we were chatting, and an hour and a half later, I went, oh, my God, look at the time. I said, I better go. So I got up to leave, and he said, it was lovely meeting you. And I said, oh, I really enjoyed our chat, and off I went about my business. So when I left, he turned around to my friend, and he said, oh, your friend's a lovely woman. And she's, of course, cheeky. She said, Well, why don't you ask her out?
Lorraine, I'm going to have to cut short and to the very, very end.
Okay.
And
so
tell people that...
And he... Oh, we went out and we're still together. Okay. And he's a lovely, lovely, kind man.
Lorraine, I'm delighted to hear that. And I'm sure your Dave would love to hear it too and be happy for you. On your first night out, talk about you, shoot your score.
Furthest thing from my mind, I can tell you.
Lorraine, thanks so much for sharing all of that with us. And
Susan, thank you. An absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much.